and welcome to the Partners in FinCrime podcast in association with FSCom. My name is Evan McGookin and I'm a senior manager in the FinCrime team here.
My name is Chris Fawn and I'm a senior associate in the FinCrime team.
In this podcast series, we'll be looking to discuss all things anti-financial crime.
We'll be deep diving into cutting-edge stories as well as other interesting topics in the financial crime space. This episode, we'll be touching on a number of topics, starting with the European Court of Justice's recent decision on the legality of public UBO registers, the recent financial penalties against Santander for AML failings, and the situation surrounding the cryptocurrency exchange FTX.
Hey Chris, how's it going?
Hi Evan, how's things?
Yeah, very well, thanks, very well. Very much on the countdown to Christmas now, and obviously football didn't come home in the end, so how do you feel about that?
Yeah, very disappointing in the end, wasn't it? France are a very good team though, so if they go on and win it, then I suppose it's not as bad losing to the ultimate winner. Yeah, you've been watching the games?
Bits and bobs. I think it's been difficult with it being winter to try and keep an eye on it as much as you maybe would if it was during summer, particularly with the colder weather and maybe not getting out and having a barbecue and whatnot whilst the matches are on. But it has been good. With that being said, looking forward to the Christmas fixture pile-up and all that good stuff for club football.
Indeed.
So a busy time in the world of football and a busy time, as always, in the world of anti-financial crime. I think a lot has happened over the past 3-4 weeks, and I think we'll probably use this podcast to discuss quite a bit of it. And in my mind, there's a few things for us to think about, which is potentially the ongoing situation with UBO registers across the EU, the FCA's final notice on Santander UK PLC's historic AML failings, and the recent situation with FTX and what that ultimately means. So I guess to sort of kick things off and jump in with the first thing I mentioned there, which would be the ongoing situations with UBO registers across the EU, I would probably consider myself to be a bit of a nerd when it comes to these macro legislative situations. And the guts of this one, which I found really interesting, was the European Court of Justice basically ruling that a key provision of the fourth and fifth MLDs, which was essentially that the UBO, so you know, ultimate beneficial owner registers, are made available to any member of the public. The Court of Justice basically ruled that as being invalid on the basis of it being a serious interference with the fundamental rights to respect for private life and the protection of personal data. I think where this is quite interesting for financial crime people, for compliance people, and for the practitioner on the ground, is that a number of those UBO registers across the EU were at that point temporarily suspended, and some actually still remain down at the time of recording. I think it's fair to say that the actual implementation of UBO registers has probably been spotty at best across the block, but it's hard not to see this really as a pretty disappointing step backwards, and it'll be interesting to see what comes next. Will they stay down? Will they go back up? Will they be replaced with non-public registers, but registers maybe that law enforcement or financial institutions can access? I think this is probably one that we can have a bit of an open discussion on, and more than anything, I think it's something that is going to be very interesting to keep an eye on, which is why I wanted to mention it in this podcast, to make sure everybody's aware of the goings and shakings around this. Do you have any broad thoughts on this one? Any thoughts on what it means for the MLRO or the practitioner on the ground when it comes to the disappearance of some UBO registers across the EU?
Well, as the self-avowed nerd on this, Evan, I think I'd be interested to know your opinions. So what's some of the potential outcomes of this and what, you know, what impact could this have?
Yeah, I think there's probably a few things. I think it's sort of an ongoing battle, even not just in compliance and financial crime, but in general, you know, that security, privacy, so forth, the balance of governance and sort of supranational organizations like the EU to try and balance transparency against privacy. And I think if publicly available UBO registers are no more, then, well, one thing you might hope for is that they're going to be replaced with a more effective form of corporate registry. A danger, though, to that point might be that you could potentially see varying levels of transparency developing across the EU, particularly with respect to how the UK sort of matches up against that. The danger really of Companies House obviously undergoing reform in the UK at the minute, the Economic Crime Bill and all of that reform that's been promised to them for some time seems to be moving in a positive direction now. And obviously in the UK, the PSC register remains open. I think if there is a variation of approach between the EU and the UK and even a variation of approach in different states across the EU, then you could see varying levels of transparency developing. You could see certainly, you know, the potential for some divergence between the UK and the EU if this judgment remains as is. I think it's important probably to recognise that I think this has been appealed or at the time of recording, this isn't settled law. But I do think the MLRO or the practitioner probably needs to be alert just in a look forward horizon scanning sort of way to the potential for like arbitrage, if that's even the right word to use. So criminals maybe looking to abuse systems with lesser transparency and how this might develop down the line. So maybe even look ahead and see how this affects country risk in the future. I think the second point would be just to monitor it as well. I think the registers are down at the moment, meaning nobody can really check them as part of CDD. So what does that mean? Are firms who have an obligation to check these registers or an obligation to report discrepancies in breach now of local MLRRs? In practice, is anybody going to get censured for that? Maybe not, or at least not at the moment. But if this all goes away in a few weeks and those registers are reinstated, but firms have onboarded clients in that time without access to UBO registers, then, you know, are you then in breach for not having checked those registers? Are you going to want to go back and do that CDD if everything opens up? The approach there, I think, has to be rationalised. But again, if it all goes back to normal and you end up not having a complete client file, then you may be in breach. So again, it's a very open sort of situation at the minute. My recommendation would be just to keep an eye on the developing legal situation and act accordingly.
Yeah, so I think what you've said there all makes sense to me. Do you think that there's a valid argument there that privacy could override or overrule AML concerns?
I think that's a pretty tough one, to be honest. I know in the judgment itself, it was essentially ruled invalid on the basis of interfering with the right to respect for private life and the protection of personal data. So I guess there's two points to that. Protection of personal data, number one, you know, whether or not a truly open public register is effective in mitigating those AML concerns, as you mentioned. It might be debatable the extent to which that actually in practice does, but you know, if you were to take that away, then ultimately you're going to be relying on fully resourced, you know, FIUs, law enforcement and such being able to access a non-public register. And we know from experience that those entities would like more resource. So it's tough to see the protection of personal data being more important in that sense. Fundamental rights to respect for private life. Again, I'm not a lawyer here. I'm just a bit of a nerd. But is it really private life when you're sort of availing of the legal protections of the state to incorporate an entity? Seems to me probably that goes beyond private life. And the EU, as they went through the MLDs, was pushing for this transparency. So it's curious that we've sort of got to this position now where they seem to be tracking back on that. I think it's all generated from originally a court case in Luxembourg, which we talked about sort of varying levels of transparency. I think in the EU, Luxembourg's probably one of the higher levels of transparency compared to others. So we'll have to see how it shakes out. I guess it's just, you know, the EU has differing sort of legislative and regulatory and legal standings across its bloc. But we'd have to hope that it ends up in a positive situation. So yeah, tough to answer, but I think again, one just to watch the space.
Yeah, definitely one to watch. You know, coming from our perspective, I think obviously we would always want to see more transparency, but as you say, it's difficult when there's other considerations. But as you've said there, one to watch. Keep an eye on that. It's a developing topic. So, yeah. What else do we need to discuss today, Evan?
Second big story of the day is probably Santander and the recent regulatory action that Santander UK PLC, so its UK operation, if I recall specifically, its business banking operation, was fined ultimately some 107 million by the UKFCA for historical AML failings across the period of 2012 to 2017. I think that was down from an initial penalty of 153 million or so. So a decent discount on that, but still a pretty hefty penalty issued by the UK regulator. The final notice, again, Chris, you're a nerd, I'm a nerd when it comes to these type of things. The final notice is well worth reading if you're into that type of thing. And a lot of the focus has been on, and I remember we discussed this last week, but customer A, which is a good sort of use case, a good example of some of the issues that may have been in place at Santander at the time. To sort of summarize them, customer A basically purported, do I remember correctly, Chris, to be a translation service?
I think it came to light that they were a money services business, but I'm not sure if they originally purported to be a translation service. Perhaps that detail is included. I think maybe before you dive into the specifics, just to give it a bit more context, maybe, customer A was a business banking customer of Santander. And the reason obviously it's characterized as customer A is for confidentiality reasons. But the interesting thing around this is there's quite a detailed investigation within the FCA's final notice, which actually discusses the activity and the failings that happened around this individual case. So it's, as Evan says there, it's well worth a read. But that maybe gives some more context. So sorry, Evan, to cut you off there, but jump into it because it is interesting. I think it's something we can get our teeth into a little bit.
So I think I have just opened it up. Yeah. So maybe, was it Santander characterized them as a translation service at the point of onboarding? But yes, as you say, they then turned out to be very much not that. At the outset, customer A was looking to facilitate transactions of about 5k a month GBP sterling, and ultimately end up doing millions more than that. As you say, it turned out it was an MSB, so a money service business, conducting payments and transactions on behalf of its underlying clients, so clients of Santander's client, customer A. And as we all know, the risk of nested relationships is you don't have that visibility of the underlying source of funds, the underlying clients, and such. A few problems then manifested. So the initial miscategorization, obviously through the application of a risk-based approach out of whack. The final notice talks about there being significant resource pressure on the SOAR unit, meaning TM alerts were not actioned in a timely manner. It talked about there being a lack of periodic reviews for all high-risk clients. So no periodic reviews for low or medium-risk clients, meaning that outside of trigger events, those clients wouldn't be reviewed. So that sort of ties into the last two things I mentioned, which is client was miscategorized, so they weren't high-risk, even though they should have been. So they weren't captured by periodic review, but then TM was overdue as well, so trigger events were also not reviewed in a timely manner. So it's a bit of a compounding issue. And then finally, a quite interesting point in there was the notice talking about silos and and ultimately compliance being a centralized function sort of being fed into by disparate teams with limited MI, limited data sharing, meaning that when the time finally came for the decision to be made to close the account, after 3 or 4 years of this entity being open, when that decision was finally made to close the account, it then took another 5 months before that was actioned. So what's take from this? What does it mean for the practitioner? I think first off, I'll sort of jump in a bit, but the failings were over a period of 2012 to 2017. So this is all relatively historic, but you know, I think some of those key points have popped up and we probably actually talked about some of it in last week's episodes. So there's a lot of crossover even today in what we published in the FSCOM Compliance Audit Report 2022. So governance, backlogs, resource, onboarding gaps, systems, TM, inefficiencies. A lot of that isn't at all specific to Santander. It's just a good example of how these risks can manifest and crystallize. So I recommend everybody goes and reads that Compliance Audit Report 2022. It hits on all that good stuff. But probably the most interesting broad point from this for me, and I'm aware I'm sort of droning on here a bit, but I saw in the report a few references to the prioritization of the completion of processes above qualitative assessments. So it's that whole thing, tick box compliance. What do the risk-based approach actually mean? Is it the implementation of the core components of a risk-based approach? So like customer risk assessments, WFRAs, rather than having an actual risk-based approach? Or is it just the application of a risk-based approach in a rules-based way? So putting all these components in place, but then actually not driving qualitative assessments. I think it's, yeah, clear that a lot probably went wrong. Is there any of those points that stick out in your mind as being particularly wild?
I think a couple of clarifications. I think one really interesting piece you've mentioned there, that you know, they started out with a desire to conduct £5,000, was it at £5,000 a month, and we should be clear on the numbers. By the time the account was closed, £269 million had moved through the account, which almost beggars belief, really. And obviously we don't know the internal processes, we don't know exactly the failings that led to this, but the FCA's characterizations in some cases do raise eyebrows. Certainly around, I mean, there's a few pieces. For me, the most interesting things probably to start with, customer risk assessments, an issue that you see time and time again, not adequately identifying the nature of business, first of all, and then being able to understand whether that poses a particularly high risk. And then it's really that whole risk assessment process as it pertains to customers. You start with an understanding of the risk that a customer might pose, but as any compliance professional knows, or at least should know, a customer risk assessment process doesn't finish once the onboarding process finishes. And it's that ongoing monitoring, that ongoing risk assessment, that reviewing piece, that coming back and not only are we going to review KYC information and documentation, but we're going to compare the actual activity with what we expected. And you always have to be comparing reality with expectations, really. And I think for me, perhaps that's the overarching message, is risk assessments don't stop once your onboarding process is finished. The fact that it got so out of hand is obviously an egregious example, I suppose, and that this particular case seems to have got missed so many times over and over that it's become this extremely impactful and is blown out of all proportions, really, that you might expect. But nonetheless, I think that's really probably the issue that led to that. And again, I suppose there's also transaction monitoring as well. I mean, that's an issue that's happened time and time again. We're seeing transaction monitoring, below the line testing, not well calibrated transaction monitoring systems. So yeah, those are probably the two key bits for me. What do you think?
Yeah, agreed. I think, as you say, obviously the regulatory obligation when it comes to TM is to conduct ongoing monitoring of a you know, customer relationship to include scrutiny of transactions, and that term scrutiny is key, which has to be built on a full assessment of risk of expected nature and purpose at the point of onboarding. And then to your point on below the line, above the line testing, ensuring that your application and approach to TM enables the scrutinization of client activity. So it's not just the system generating noise, it's actually the importance of it generating actionable intelligence, enabling you to scrutinize activity against expected nature and purpose to then create, you know, undertake some sort of event-driven trigger and whatnot. As you say too, yeah, ensuring that, yeah, again, that governance has to be in place. The three lines of defense model, ensuring that this case in particular, where it's been missed a few times, it is actually actioned by the different business units, and sort of, again, just ensuring that there's no miscategorizations, there's no compounding issues, there's no silos not feeding into each other and actually taking the action that should be. Where this sort of came into play too is, again, resourcing. It says it in the final notice, but it talks about the SAR unit being under significant resource pressure, and the SAR unit was the unit that was responsible for the investigation of the TM alerts. And, you know, just think about what the ethos of a risk-based approach is. It's the application of resource to areas where the risk is highest, to mitigate that risk. Santander, it seems in this case, had major resource issues, and they didn't then have the process or the controls to stop the crystallization of those issues. So yeah, it's just a broad failure really in a few different regards, but again, it's well worth reading. It hits on many of the common issues that we see across the business, and I think hopefully it's something that the wider industry is able to learn from.
Yeah, definitely. I think, as you say, whether financial crime shouldn't just be in a silo, it should come down from the top in terms of strategy, in terms of governance, and yeah, you would want your senior management to understand and to be able to allocate necessary resource, I suppose. And as you say, perhaps there's a little bit of under-resourcing problems there as well. I think for me, the final thing that I'll mention is just on compliance monitoring as well. And mm-hmm. And what do I mean by that? That being, once you've built your AML controls, fine, okay, great, but how are we going to ensure that they're actually performing, that they're doing the job that we designed them to? You set up an AML control to do a specific job, and how are you going to test that it not only is it functioning as expected, but that it's actually doing a good job, and that it's giving you things, well, stopping the right kinds of things that it was designed to stop, really, that it's mitigating the relevant risk that it was designed for. So I think there's probably some failings there. Again, I mentioned transaction monitoring, but not just setting up your transaction monitoring in the first instance, but then developing an appropriate compliance monitoring framework to go ahead and then test on a regular basis. And that can be testing through testing the system. Is it actually flagging the right things that you've designed it for, whether that's, you know, testing SQL rules or whatever it may be within your system, or whether it's sampling, you're picking a sample of files and saying, or alerts rather, and saying, okay, let's go check first of all that these were triggered correctly, but let's go check that the investigations were done right, that the correct escalation channels were followed. All of these things, I think, come into it and play a really big part. So I think, yeah, compliance monitoring is how you figure out things that perhaps are not as great as you perhaps thought they were. So I do think that's another thing to mention on this as well. Yeah.
Agrees. I think if that framework was in place to monitor the actual efficacy of the systems and controls, then yeah, this may not have ended up in the situation that it did. I think that's a really good point.
So perhaps we can finish off our topic roundup for the week with one that's perhaps a little bit old in the news, I suppose. Now it's been around for a few weeks, but of course this is only our second podcast, Evan. So that's the situation as it surrounds FTX, I suppose, the demise of FTX and the whole story around that. What's your thoughts there? I mean, it's probably a larger than financial crime issue, but obviously for our purposes, I think there's some interest in Some interesting pieces, definitely around governance, certainly a more wider or a wider rather regulatory impact, definitely in the crypto space. But any thoughts in particular there?
Yeah, I think the FTX case is a really interesting one. I think it's much broader than FTX and the themes that we can probably pull out of it. I think fundamentally, when you look at it, it's a question of inadequate governance structures, potentially incorporation in jurisdictions that, to the discussion we had at the very start of this, have lesser degrees of transparency, lesser requirements on sort of corporate behaviour, and ultimately just aren't equivalent to the UK or the EU. So obviously FTX was predominantly in the BVI, if I recall. Again, I think it's one that we'll have to monitor and see how the wider reaction is to crypto from the fallout with FTX. What are national and supranational regulators going to, what's their reaction going to be? Are they going to be more averse to approving FASPs for AML supervision? I know we've obviously seen the EU floating the idea of bringing crypto more into scope for regulation, and I think recently the UK has been presenting that with music too. I think the current UK government seems to have been quite keen to try and make the UK a bit of a driver of the crypto industry and crypto growth and regulation and supervision. I know certainly the FCA's approach to VASP supervision really is more akin to authorization than supervision in the classical AML supervision sense. So I guess there's a few things there. The extent to which your crypto, not your keys, not your crypto. This is what they always say in crypto, isn't it, right? The extent to which those funds will ever be safeguarded to the same extent as they would in a credit institution. Yeah, again, I think it's one to watch this space. I think it's, even though this was 4 or 5 weeks ago, I think we're going to be watching the ripples of this happen for some time.
Yeah, fair enough. I understand the points you've made, I suppose. The thing for me, I think, is, well, one thing you've said there is governance failure. I think that might be understatement of the century. I don't think there was any governance at all when it comes to FTX. I don't know if all the stories that came out are 100% accurate, but one of the ones was that basically this was being run by a bunch of friends, like 10 friends living in the same house. And that was the entirety of the structure of FTX's setup when it comes to sort of corporate framework. Is obviously quite amazing, really. The usage of customer funds potentially to leverage and things like this is obviously all smacks of just, it's not good, I suppose, in terms of a picture for the crypto asset industry. But I think it's also important to point out that it shouldn't necessarily have a reflection on crypto asset as a asset class. There's no reason that cryptocurrency should really have anything to do with what happened, because this could have really, I mean, aside from the lack of regulation, they could have been doing anything and it would have been terrible. It could have been, you know, if a company that deals in gold, for example, goes and does these kinds of crazy things with its customers' funds, then you don't blame gold. It's not gold's fault. So I understand the ripple effects and the nature of the volatility of crypto in any case is always going to suffer that, unfortunately. But firms that act like this are on borrowed time, I suppose. That's perhaps the overarching message. And you know, we know that more regulation is coming into the crypto space. You've got MiCA and other things that are coming on the horizon, and hopefully that will introduce a level of protection for customers more than is in place currently. I think it's such an interesting story, but I do hope that it doesn't dissuade people from thinking that blockchain is a useful or an interesting invention, because I still think that it's absolutely, you know, the fundamentals of crypto are still there. It's just that you are going to get bad actors in a space like this, particularly in such a novel, ever developing and emerging space such as crypto. You're going to get these kinds of things happen whether you like it or not, and particularly as governments move to try to regulate, there's going to be a lag, there's going to be a gap, and there's always going to be a learning curve, I suppose. So yeah, those are the key takeaways for me, maybe, and And again, as me and you are compliance professionals, obviously, I think we're always going to fall on the side of regulation to try to create more trust, I suppose, because we need to reestablish trust in the crypto space. And the other side of this crypto winter could look very different. And we'll just have to wait and see, I suppose.
Agreed. Yeah, I think that's a really good point. It's a great opportunity for the firms that want to do it right as well, and the firms that want to put in place those correct governance structures to comply with regulations and guidance as best they can, to engage with public and private organizations to try and build that consumer trust and really help to build a regulatory framework that is more akin to the financial services industry as it is at the minute. And it's a great opportunity for the firms that want to do that in the crypto sphere.
Yeah, absolutely. That's it. Build resilient framework and compliant, you know, compliant frameworks that look after the customer, and you will succeed, perhaps, is the message. And bad actors will get found out eventually. And you know, I suppose the proof is in the pudding in that sense. So yeah, it's a really interesting case, but I wouldn't want it to be a reflection on cryptocurrency as a whole. That's my thoughts anyway. Look, Evan, I think we've spoke for a bit of time. We've covered some good topics. Any final thoughts this week?
No, I think that's pretty much it for me, aside to say I hope you have a good Christmas. I hope you have lots of eggnog and eat lots of turkey and have a merry time. Hope you get some good time off to sort of chill, and happy Christmas to everybody else who may be listening. I think next time we may have a special guest on with us, everybody's favorite Geordie compliance director and Emily Rose. So I think that's something to look forward to in the new year. But yeah, hope you have a good Christmas.
And you, Merry Christmas. And Christmas. I'll see you in the new year.
See ya. Thank you.